Greetings and New Year's revelations, my infamously concupient listeners, and welcome to this January 2016 Science News Update. I'm your host for this farcically ridiculous science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. I've just flown back from Peru, and boy, are my arms tired. Sorry, I've always wanted to make that horrendously moldy joke. However, the gist of it is correct, and I just got back from going to a wedding in the Andes last week. Let me make two observations about Peru and the Andes. Both are kind of sciencey, so bear with me. I try not to convey science with anecdotes, but sometimes you really don't have much of a choice. My first observation. I don't care what anybody tells me. Unless you are born there, I'm not sure you can ever really get used to the level of oxygen, or the lack of oxygen, at the 12,000-foot altitude. My friend and former student who got married there assured me that I would acclimate in a couple of days. I never did. After 4 days, I still sounded like an asthmatic combined with a chronic heart patient on their last legs. And I actually sounded worse when we went several thousand feet higher into the mountains for sightseeing. I never actually got altitude sickness, but I certainly wasn't feeling very healthy for the time that I was there. The Peruvians of the high Andes have two remedies for blancos like me who can't get enough oxygen at that 58 to 63% level that you find up in the mountains. First, there's coca tea. Not cocoa, coca, as in the source of cocaine. The tea was available gratis 24/7 at the front desk of our hotel. Leaves, tea, even coca candy can be found on every street corner or drugstore down there. And I was warned, don't even think about bringing any of it back to the United States. Even the candy may land you in jail. Apparently, U.S. customs officials are very serious people. By the way, I never partook of the coca tea, mainly because it tasted like, let's just say it was very unpleasant. The second remedy that the Andeans use for dealing with low oxygen is hypercaffeinated coffee. I was served coffee in the Andes that just about anywhere else on Earth most people would have turned their noses up at. My mother drinks espresso so black that they could use it to paint the backdrops on Star Trek. So I know black coffee. Andean coffee goes a step beyond that. I think that each demitasse cup was equal to about 5 or 6 mugs of Starbucks. Now think about that for a moment, if you're a Starbucks aficionado. Starbucks is actually formulated to be super caffeinated. But Starbucks Americano coffee is like a kiddie drink to the Andeans. I have never in my life literally seen black coffee before. Thick black coffee. You read about it in bad books, but I have finally seen it. Coffee in the Andes isn't coffee unless it is as thick as maple syrup. The natives can drink this stuff black, as I witnessed, but I needed about a half gallon of milk to make it palatable for every demitasse. The amazing part was that it actually made me feel better. I think the massive influx of caffeine was able to at least temporarily counteract the effects of anoxia, just like the coca, which is another stimulant, by the way. I think an adrenaline injection straight to the heart would have had the same effect as either, but hey, that was asking just a bit too much of my hosts. My children were horrified when they found out that my lovely wife and I ate cuy while we were in Peru. Cuy, for the unversed, is one of the national dishes of the country. It is spit-roasted guinea pig. As friends told me down there, cuy have been eaten for centuries because they reproduce so fast, and because they eat a very simple vegetarian diet. I know the question on all your minds, how does it taste? Well, kind of like rabbit, but way less fatty. After eating one, I can tell you seriously, it was a shame I bothered. There wasn't much there to make it worth it. Unless you chew it down to the bones, you're not going to get much of a meal, which is why I was surprised that a half guinea pig was even on the cafe menu where we ate. I was still hungry after a whole guinea pig. Why am I telling you the cuy story? There's a point. Bear with me. the Cooey had its revenge, so to speak, on my digestive tract. My children cheered when I told them that. I will not go into detail, but suffice it to say, I was in distress and needed medication. Here's where the sciencey bit comes in. Many of you listeners are not from the United States, and I will readily admit that I now realize that I don't know how obtaining medication works in other countries. For those of you not familiar with the U.S., you go to a doctor, he or she checks you out, and you get a prescription for the medicine, which is then made available in a drugstore, a pharmacy, which will not sell those medicines to you otherwise. With over-the-counter medicines, such as, let's say, Imodium as a random example, you can simply buy them off the shelves. When my wife and I walked into Mia Farmacia in Lima, there was not a single medicine out on the shelves, not even aspirin. When I saw this, I figured, good gosh, this is going to be a serious chore getting medicine. We may have to go to a doctor. Boy, was I wrong. We explained what the problem was to the pharmacist, and she came back with a box. And I was expecting, well, a commercial box that looked, let's say, like, randomly Imodium. This was a generic box of pills, which obviously had come directly from the drug company. The conversation carried out in a mixture of Spanish and broken English went something like this. Us. What's this? Pharmacist. Your medicine. Us. Okay, but what is it? Pharmacist. Anorex. Us. What is that? Pharmacist. For your symptoms. Us, shrugging. Okay, I guess. I reach for the box and the pharmacist shakes her head. No, how many do you want? Us, with me staring in disbelief. How many do I need? Pharmacist, confused and shaking her head. No, how many do you want? Us, we don't understand. How many does one normally need? Pharmacist, as many as you want. This should not have come as a surprise to me in a country where coca is made into candy. Us again, desperately flipping through the Spanish phrase book, which does not cover this. What is the normal dosage over several days? Pharmacist, 600 milligrams per day, 3 times a day at each meal. Which, by the way, was untrue. More than a bit mistrustful, I looked it up later online. You were not supposed to take more than 400 milligrams per day of this particular medicine. Us, can we see the box? Pharmacist, see. She shrugs and hands it over. Us, this has antibiotics in it. Pharmacist, see. Us, not really getting across a rather complex idea in either Spanish or English. Isn't there a minimum time this should be taken? Taking antibiotics for too short a treatment can create serious problems. Pharmacist. A shrug. Me under my breath. Did you actually go to pharmacy school? Pharmacist. So, how many pills do you want? Even though the prescription of antibiotics in the U.S. is strictly controlled, unless apparently you're a cow, that is not the case in Peru. Frankly, I would love to do a study to see if this free use of antibiotics has led to more drug-resistant bacteria down there than even in the U.S. Now, I am a fairly libertarian kind of guy. I believe the government should stay the heck out of people's lives. But I can honestly say that seeing how pharmaceuticals are so freely handed out down in Peru made me much more of a liberal. Regulate everything, please. People need to be taken care of when it comes to this stuff. This is just dangerous and crazy. I'm not sure how the rest of the world deals with pharmaceuticals, but Peru kind of worries me. At any rate, why don't we actually get to the first story of the night, the first official story? Over the last year or two in newspapers and science journals, scientists have gone on and on about how much of the human body is made up of bacteria. Most scientists, in fact, have insisted that more of the body is made of bacteria than actual human cells, which I have found less than believable and more than a little stupid because the human cells may be fewer, but they are way larger by thousands of times. So saying a human is more bacteria than human is insulting and incorrect. even if there are more bacteria. Well, new evidence suggests that I was pretty much correct in my beliefs that the human body is not primarily made up of bacteria. Doctors Ron Sender, Shai Fuchs, and Ron Milo of the Weizmann Institute in Israel report a new study online January 6th at biorxiv.org. And their report is that human bodies do not contain 10 times more bacteria than human cells. There is a ratio of about 1.3 bacteria for every cell in your body. Or if you weigh about 150 pounds, that's about 30 trillion human cells to about 40 trillion bacterial cells. And again, since each human cell is thousands of times bigger, the actual mass of a human is not half bacterial. It is primarily human, so do not freak out. The authors say their estimate could be off by as much as 25%, with the average number of bacteria ranging from 30 trillion to 50 trillion. Among individual people, the bacterial count could vary as much as 52%, say, with a fudge factor of 10 trillion to 20 trillion bacteria. The number of microbes may pretty well match the number of human cells in the body, which also varies somewhat. The researchers write in their paper, quote, "Indeed, the numbers are similar enough that each defecation event may flip the ratio to favor human cells over bacteria." Unquote. Oh, yeah, lovely, ew. As I said, the scientists who study the microbiome have estimated that bacteria outnumber human cells anywhere from 10 to 1 or even 100 to 1, which is even more absurd. This new paper reports not only on bacterial cells, but the number of actual human cells as well. And you can whip out these factoids next time you want to bore that special someone in a cocktail party or bar. For example, the team found that red blood cells are the most numerous cells in the body, accounting for 84% of cells in the body by number, which is quite a bit. By weight, on the other hand, muscle and fat are heavy hitters, making up actually 75% of the actual cell mass. But those cells tend to be big and represent only a tenth of a percent of the human body cell number altogether. As expected, most of the bacteria in the body, about 39 trillion, live in the colon. Women tend to have smaller blood volume than men, so their bacteria to human cell ratio may be about 30% higher than that of men, the researchers calculate. Growing children probably fall within the range of bacteria to human cell ratios of adult men. Obesity doesn't change the ratio much, the team calculated. Okay, next story. For many years, we have believed that the state of your body does not alter genetics for your offspring. This has been a mainstay of genetics for at least 100 years. But with epigenetics, this idea seems to be kind of thrown out the window and changes every day. And it's become more and more of a question of, does what happened in this generation affect the next generation or two or three generations down the line? And the latest is this. If you are male and obese, it will affect the genetic status of your sperm cells and probably affect your offspring. Dr. Romain Barrès and his team of researchers from the University of Copenhagen discovered differences in the sperm epigenomes of lean and obese men and the sperm of obese men before and after bariatric surgery, according to a study published last month, December 3rd, in the journal Cell Metabolism. The results support the idea that fathers' environments can be encoded in their sperm, with potential downstream effects on embryos. The Copenhagen research team recruited 24 Danish men between the ages of 24 and 40 and classified them as lean or obese based on their BMI. And each volunteer provided a single ejaculate sample. The researchers scanned the sperm's genomic DNA for methylation patterns and measured levels of small non-coding RNAs, which helped to regulate those epigenetic changes. They discovered significantly different levels of DNA methylation between the skinny and the fat volunteers in more than 9,000 genes. Of these, 274 had been previously implicated in appetite control. Just to remind you, methylation of genes, or the area near genes, seems to be the major way that we have so far discovered that epigenetic inheritance occurs. Genes can be turned on and off by having reduced levels of methylation in the DNA near them, or increased levels. Anyway, Barrez says, quote, "We were surprised. We could have expected that it would be genes related to metabolism or adipose tissue that would be important. To find genes related to brain function was really unexpected," unquote. Barrez and his team also collected sperm samples from six obese men who were undergoing gastric bypass surgery. The researchers collected sperm samples 1 week before surgery, 1 week after surgery, and then a year later. The analysis revealed 1,509 genes with altered methylation patterns a week after the procedure compared to pre-surgical methylation. At 1 year post-surgery, the number had increased to 3,900. Though Barrez noted that the sperm epigenomes after gastric bypass surgery did not necessarily resemble those seen in moderately obese or lean individuals. Barrez says, quote, "Obese men have information that can be transferred to children that could potentially affect their eating behavior. And this information can be changed if obese men lose weight. Our study does not show what is transmitted to children, but it is likely that something is being transmitted, and it will change brain development and behavior," unquote. My, my. Sounds very provocative, doesn't it, I guess? But I suppose the important thing is that a father does make his mark epigenetically on the offspring, and not just by the standard genetics that we have all known about for many years. Okay, next story. Is there something blacker than Peruvian coffee? Heck yes, there is. I came across this little article in the Daily Mirror. What would you do if you were unable to see something that is right in front of you? Well, I suppose you may be going blind, but that's not what I meant. You might be looking at a substance called Vanta Black. This material is so black that it simply cannot be seen by the human eye. Talking about something so visual in an audio podcast is a bit stupid, but you may want to look up a photo of this stuff when you have a minute. Our vision works by picking up reflected photons, light, from the objects around us, which provide our brain with the source to construct the world we see. Vanta Black absorbs 99.9% of all light that strikes its surface, a bit like a black hole. Therefore, no photons are being reflected for our vision to pick up, which is why we can't see it. Our brains try to make sense of the situation by shading color of other materials and objects around Vanta Black and trying to provide us with something to actually observe and look at. In reality, when we're looking at Vanta Black, we're just not able to see anything because there's nothing to see. As it stands, this stuff is officially the darkest substance known to man. People have described Vanta Black like staring into a black hole or absolute nothingness, as if there is literally a dark black hole there. Pretty amazing. Next story. Will aging soon be a thing of the past? Yeah, sure it will. Forgive my cynical attitude, but I have read too many SF novels to believe that if anyone ever came up with an effective way of keeping humans from aging, it would ever see the light of day. Yes, I sound like those old codgers who insist that Detroit car makers invented an automobile that ran on water but suppressed it away decades ago. But look, I'm sorry, I just can't help it. Dr. Antonio Carrez at the Cellular Neurobiology Laboratory at the Salk Institute and his colleagues reported last month in the journal Aging that the synthetically developed compound J147 has shown both anti-Alzheimer and anti-aging effects. In rapidly aging mice, it restored vascular health, improved synaptic function, reduced brain inflammation, and also reduced other degenerative symptoms that are shared between aging and dementia. Carrez said, quote, "The problem we've faced in treating Alzheimer's is that most drugs have been developed based on an assumption that amyloid plaque formation in the brain is the main cause of Alzheimer's to be targeted. But these drugs have all failed. We instead sought a different approach, by trying to identify the age-related causes of late-onset Alzheimer's disease, which would account for 99% of the cases. Unquote. The team looked at expressed genes and proteins in RNA to examine age-associated molecular changes in the brain and blood of three groups of rapidly aging mice. They then treated one group of older mice with J147 for 7 months and compared their behavior and molecular data with young control mice and untreated older mice. The J147-fed group showed significantly improved locomotor activity and better performance on memory and cognition tests. The treated mice also displayed genetic and metabolic data profiles resembling the younger mice, rather than the control group of, well, old mice. Carey said that, quote, "We saw positive anti-aging effects on the blood-brain vasculature, as well as reduced brain inflammation and improved oxidative stress and energy metabolism. We are conducting lifespan studies now, but so far J147 has shown beneficial effects to overall health," unquote. He finishes with, "Yes, while J147 must undergo more preliminary tests before human testing, next year another anti-aging drug, metformin, will become the first of its kind to enter human clinical trials. These studies could help raise consciousness for the idea that we need to look for other age-related aspects that could be the deeper cause of Alzheimer's and other diseases. It could have a huge benefit," unquote. Next story. Here's a short one from Nature Communications this month, from the lab of Lennart Muck at the University of California. Historically, the BRCA genes are the ones best known for inducing breast cancer when they stop functioning. My understanding, and what I teach in class, has always been that they are tumor suppressor genes. BRCA1 and BRCA2 protect cells, especially those that are very sensitive to estrogen, like breast tissue and ovarian tissue. And these genes help to keep rogue cancer cells from ever growing. So it came as a bit of a surprise to me when I read this article that suggests that BRCA1 may have something to do with Alzheimer's. Yes, cue the previous story. Nothing having to do with neuronal tissue has ever been suggested for this gene. Despite whatever the past has suggested, new evidence in mouse Alzheimer models suggests that the BRCA1 gene may also have a role in regulating neuronal function. In fact, in this paper, the Nature Communications report, the authors observed that there were greatly reduced levels of BRCA1 in patients who had Alzheimer's, and in vitro in mouse neural cell cultures. Based on the results of this study, the presence of amyloid beta interfered with the proper BRCA1 expression. In turn, loss of BRCA1 appeared to contribute to increases in neuronal plaques and shrinkage, as well as deficits in learning and memory. Ultimately, BRCA1 expression as amyloid beta levels increase could be another therapeutic option for reversing clinical effects of Alzheimer's. And no, not just in women, but in men as well. All right, last story of the night. Crows. Three-eyed crows? Night watch crows? Messenger crows? All right, messenger ravens? George Martin certainly has his symbolism down with these birds in Game of Thrones. Why are people so fascinated with crows and or ravens? Well, we've certainly seen them throughout time as harbingers of human death and portending evil. So it's not quite so hard to believe that Martin takes advantage of such a ubiquitous type of imagery. You may want to call this the Poe effect, in fact. But there are some weird things that crows do that have to do with, well, other crows dying. Kind of strange. Doctors Callie Swift and John Marsliff from the University of Washington just published a paper this month in the journal Animal Behavior that looks at some of the strange things that crows do around their own dead. You see, crows attend funerals for fallen or dead comrades. Why? What are they getting from these meetings around their deceased? Swift and Marsliff carried out a series of experiments that are both clever and really kind of creepy. First, to gain the trust of breeding pairs of crows, they plied the birds with a favorite snack of peanuts and cheese puffs, which I understand. I like peanuts and cheese puffs. Then a few days later, and in the sight of the resident pair, volunteers in rubber masks, which don't move, showed up next to the food pile carrying dead stuffed crows in their outstretched hands. As if this wasn't disturbing enough, these ghoulish scenes were sometimes paired with a stuffed hawk, one of the crows' most feared predators. The responses to these stimuli were markedly different. While a dead crow held aloft by a masked volunteer drew the unquestioned ire of the resident pair of crows, their scolding only occasionally attracted the attention of neighboring crows. However, when crows were confronted with a dead crow paired with a stuffed hawk, huge numbers of crows invariably formed that contained additional crows recruited from outside the territory of the breeding pair. Moreover, these mobs of crows tended to be larger and more persistent, thus maximizing the scolding. Swift says, quote, "Our results aren't overly surprising. After all, hawks eat crows, and crows are smart enough to put two and two together. Dead crow plus hawk equals killer hawk. But what is especially neat about our experiment is that this contextual learning extended to the volunteer in the mask." Unquote. What does Swift mean? Well, in the 6 weeks after the main experiment, a volunteer appeared once a week with food while wearing that same rubber mask as in the original exposure. Remarkably, even after weeks, more than a third of the crows continued to mob and scold the masked person. In short, the crows had learned that this person was a potential predator, both through her association with the dead crow and also through her association with the hawk. Thus, not only are crows capable of assigning guilt by association, but their memory of these associations can potentially persist for months or longer. So what does this really imply about crow funerals? Well, it pretty much means that crows are not interested in every dead thing that crosses their path. When the team repeated the experiment with a dead pigeon instead of a dead crow, the crows couldn't care less. The authors concluded that crows gather around their dead to gain insight into how to avoid a similar fate. By this cautious approach, even if the threat is a creepy masked doctoral student, crows can quickly learn to respond with suitable caution. After all, why risk death for a pile of peanuts? Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Be careful if you're offered cooey at a meal. Don't mix up Vanta Black with Peruvian coffee. Do not trust crows, of the night watch or otherwise. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.